Welcome back to Stacktrace, life and technology from two developers' perspective, which is me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
I'm tired of being at home.
Yeah, I can imagine. You're still like in complete lockdown, right?
Pretty much, yeah. It's been relaxed a little bit, but still like masks everywhere, measuring temperature. And the job office is still almost completely closed. Like, there are some people going there. We actually went there a few weeks ago when we had the adaptive you-know-what situation.
Right, don't summon it one more time. Don't do it.
Yeah, so basically everyone was out of power at home, so we went to the office, and it was so nice to go to the office. Like, so many people complain that they have to go to an office. But I was very happy that I had an office to go to.
Yeah, I'm definitely one of these people who love to be at home. Like, I just really love being at home. I love my apartment, and
it's home.
I feel just relaxed and safe, like, being at home, right? Yeah. Like, it's not that I feel in danger when I step outside of my apartment. I'm not that scared, but I just really like being at home.
It's
but
comfy.
I will say that also this quarantine has slightly changed my opinion on being home. Like, maybe we can do it not as extreme. Like, I don't want to just be at home. Maybe I can just be outside a little bit. But here, the quarantine is more or less over, actually. Like, we still have to wear masks when we go to stores, when we're kind of in closed spaces. And a lot of people still wear masks when they're just out and about walking. But we haven't had almost any cases of COVID-19 in the city I live in, Gdansk, in almost a month now, like very, very small number of cases. So I'm still like kind of cautiously optimistic, right? Like, I don't want to treat it like it's over and we can just relax. But at the same time, I'm now able to go for a little bit longer walks with my dog, for example, like not just in my absolute closest neighborhood, but I'm still taking a lot of precautions to protect myself and others when it comes to wearing masks and things like that. Because it feels to me like wearing a mask is just like, that's the least you can do, right? It's such a small thing, but it can actually help. So why not do it?
Yeah, it's super easy. It doesn't bother me at all, even though Face ID doesn't work, but who needs their phone when they're out and about, right?
Exactly. You just put on Stacktrace. You just go to the shopping mall and there you go. You have 1.5 hours for shopping.
Use your Apple Watch.
Exactly. And use Hey Dingus and the AirPods and everything.
Yeah.
So besides being just at home, Rambo, what have you been up to?
I've been working a lot, actually. Pretty busy at the job with some projects, but I am having time to work on my own stuff. After WWDC has gone by and I have watched almost every session that I wanted to watch, I've been playing around with some things. And one of them is, so I want to make an app clip for Chibi Studio, of course. Who wouldn't want that? And I am considering using Swift UI for that app clip significantly, like quite extensively. And this weekend I was playing around with one of the key interactions, UI interactions we have in that UI, is you're able to drag the toolbar from one side to the other, and it has all of the like fluid interaction. You can throw it and it will snap to the right place. There's quite a bit of complicated interaction, and when I looked at doing it in SwiftUI, I was like, there's no way I'm gonna be able to do it, like, because it is quite tricky. But I was very pleasantly surprised, actually. I had to do it in, like, it's not as simple as just throw a V stack or whatever on screen and attach a gesture, but it is quite doable, and the best part of it is that it's much easier than doing it in UIKit. It's like, it took me quite a while because I don't know SwiftUI that well, and it's not something I've done using SwiftUI before. But in terms of the amount of code I had to write, it's like 50-ish lines of code against like 1,000 or something.
Right. I think usually the trick is that you just have to figure out what is the kind of Swift UI approach to doing a given thing, right?
Yeah.
Where the same thing applies for many different things. Like, I like to bring up the example of alert views or sheets, where when you start looking into that and you're just looking for where's the method for presenting a sheet, like where's the present and just give it a sheet as an argument and then it gets presented. But that's not the Swift UI way because it's a declarative UI framework. So you're supposed to declare all of your states up front and then what the different conditions are for presenting each of those states. So in the case of an alert or sheet, you are actually declaring it in your view hierarchy all the time, but you're then giving it the binding to that Boolean property that you want to decide whether or not they should be shown. And it's the same thing with taps and gestures and many, many other things where you are declaring it just in a different way than you might be used to if you're using UIKit or AppKit before, where you were doing more like the classic imperative way where you were saying like, here is an action handler and here I'm going to run this code. I'm going to invoke this particular thing. While in Swift UI, you're more kind of just declaring all of these different things directly within your view hierarchy.
Yeah, and I actually found two different solutions for the same problem. One of which I would say is more declarative, if that's even a thing. And the other one, which gets me pretty much 100% there with the interaction, pretty much the same as it is on the current version using UIKit. The other one got me like, I would say 90% there, but there were some subtle things that I didn't really figure out how to do with that approach. So the first approach, it was basically having two copies of the toolbar and using matched geometry effect to do the movement when you throw it to one side or the other. And the other one is actually having a custom view, which is a toolbar container view, and it will give space to the toolbar according to the current position and handle of the gesture and things like that. And I found this second approach to achieve a better result because it's more flexible, basically. I consider it a little bit less declarative than the first one, but it's still like when the user ends the gesture and I figure out where the toolbar is supposed to land, left or right, I just set like the view model property to be left or right, and that triggers the whole animation, which is really cool.
So the reason you consider it less declarative, is it because you need to manage that transition state yourself, like that gesture state yourself, rather than just letting the system decide it for you?
Yeah, basically it's because I'm not using the Swift UI layout system directly, I guess, but at the same time, like, I think it's fine because this is like a floating thing that kind of has to be able to be anywhere on screen, basically. So right. I don't feel particularly bad about that approach. And something that's super cool about the gestures in Swift UI is that they give you so much of what I basically had to do a conference talk, which was a result of like many, many, many hours of research, things such as given a gesture like a pen gesture that's ended and its velocity, where would this land on the coordinate space of the view with that velocity and with that gesture, which is basically projection, like you're projecting where something would land. And that's how you figure out, like, the user has thrown this object, where should it land? What's the closest docking station? That's how I call where the toolbar can be docked.
That's a great name.
Yeah, where will it be landing given all of these parameters? And Swift UI just gives you that. Like it gives you I think it's predicted end location or something like that. And that's just beautiful.
Like that.
You don't need to calculate it yourself.
Yeah, it's really, really nice. I would say, like, this is actually a really great example that you bring up of, I wouldn't say necessarily like that the second solution that you came up with is less declarative, but it's like you're doing more manual work, basically, right? You're relying less on the built-in behaviors of Swift UI, and you're taking things a little bit more manually and you're customizing them, but you're still doing it in a declarative way. At least it sounds like it. I haven't seen the exact code, but it sounds good. And I think this is an important point with Swift UI where sometimes I feel like people don't give it enough credit for how kind of scalable it is in terms of which level of abstraction you want to work at. Because it does sometimes seem like a black box where there are certain things you can do, certain things you can't do. But at the same time, you can always kind of dive in and use some of the raw building blocks like the gestures, like the tap interaction and things like that manually if you want to. Or you could even like bring in a UIKit view and do it completely kind of manually or the old school way if you want to. So I feel like it's easy when you're working with a new UI framework to get this kind of purist approach, right? Where you want everything to be so elegant and nice and simple and use all the built-in things. But that's not always possible in real life. Sometimes you have to do things in a more custom way. Sometimes you have to use other tools like UIKit and bring them into SwiftUI. And I think that's completely fine. I think there's nothing wrong with that. And I think actually that's a big strength of SwiftUI.
Yeah, definitely. And even using the quote less declarative approach, the code is super easy to read. It's super easy to reason about. Like, it's way easier than the UIKit version. And at the same time, like, my view is still a struct, it's still immutable, it still uses at state and things like that. So I am still keeping all of the advantages of the safety and the guarantee that I'm not going to end up in an inconsistent state like you can do with plain UIKit if you don't do things just right.
Right. Yeah, it sounds really, really good. I've also been doing some SwiftUI development.
Oh, nice. Tell me about it.
I built a game using SwiftUI.
Oh, a game. that sounds interesting.
Of course, I had to try, right? Like, yeah. I love game development, and SwiftUI is just like Core Animation and UIKit and some of these other UI frameworks. There are, at the end of the day, even though they're drawing like texts and buttons and lists and things like that, they are 2D and sometimes even 3D rendering tools, right? That's what they do. They render pixels on screen. So why couldn't you build a game using them? In fact, Imagine Engine, the game engine I wrote a couple of years ago, is built using Core Animation. It's not using Metal or OpenGL or anything. It's using Core Animation for drawing, and it's super fast. Like, because it turns out Core Animation, and we've spoken about this before, but I'm just going to rehash a little bit, that Core Animation turns out, extremely good at drawing things on the screen because that's what it does.
Surprise.
Yeah, exactly. And the same thing is true for SwiftUI as well. And I wanted to see if I were to essentially mutate my view hierarchy 60 times per second, like on every frame, update the game state and draw the view, how would that work? Would it perform nicely? And it turns out it really does, at least in my brief experiments. And I did something really funny where I built a game and I put it on GitHub, so as a gist, so we'll put a link in the show notes to it and also to the tweet that shows a little video of the game running. It's called Star Plane, and you have this plane catching stars, that's why it's called Star Plane. And all of the graphics in the game are actually SF symbols. So I have these clouds in the background that are like panning, you know, as you're flying through the sky. And the clouds are actually the iCloud icon. So I don't think I would be able to submit this to the App Store. I don't think Apple would approve of me using the iCloud icon that way.
You're violating the license, John.
Oh, damn, that was not good. Well, it was for science, right? That's how you can excuse it.
Yeah.
But it was really fun. It was really fun to do this experiment. It was just like an hour or so, just a little hack. But it was fun to see, and also just to kind of prove my theory that SwiftUI is indeed like fast enough and efficient enough to be able to get this kind of rapid updates applied to it and still render things in a very efficient manner. Of course, there's always going to be edge cases and situations where it's not going to render efficiently, and that's always going to be the case with UI frameworks. But at least this test, it really passed.
Super nice, yeah. I haven't played the game, but I've seen the video and I looked at the code. And just the fact that it fits in a gist, like it didn't even have to be like a quote real GitHub repo, is quite amazing.
Yeah, I even just developed it in a playground, so it's that's how small it is. So yeah, feel free to check it out. I mean, I wouldn't use it as like production code or, you know, as an example of how to write a SwiftUI app, but it's just a fun experiment, and you can see me playing around with some things, including gestures like you mentioned and gesture states and things like that. And yeah, it was really fun to put that together.
Yeah, definitely. I want to leave a tip here about, once again, something I've recommended many times in the past, but the CS193P cars from Stanford. This year, it's in Swift UI, and I've been following it, and I've learned a lot of things I didn't know about Swift UI. So even if you already know a little bit of Swift UI, it can be a good resource to get to know the intricacies of the framework, especially like things such as layouts and the animation system. I learned quite a bit watching the videos.
That's awesome. Yeah, we'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes as well. I want to go back a little bit, though, because you mentioned there before we started going into this deep dive into Swift UI, it's not even the deep dive segment, but we're still doing it. That's just how we do things.
It's the mini dive.
Right. You mentioned that you're going to use Swift UI for your app clip. Now, this is interesting to me because, you know, I think a lot of teams will take different approaches here when it comes to app clips, that some teams will take basically an existing feature in their app, like the actual code that they're using to render, like a view controller, for example, and use that as their app clip and try to not write a lot of new code for their app clip. But it sounds like you are writing something completely custom for the app clip, and that I feel like can also be a completely valid approach. So I'm just curious to hear what your kind of reasoning is around that.
Honestly, it's mainly because I want to do it as kind of a challenge.
That's a good reason.
Yeah, it's not like a particularly technical reason. There is some things like I want it to be a really lightweight experience, and even in terms of code size and the size of the download, which is limited to 10 megabytes. So just fitting a reduced version of our assets in those 10 megabytes has already been a challenge. So I asked my designer to create like a selection of only the essential content that we could fit in those 10 megabytes. And I'm actually using Apple's compression framework to use, I think I used the LZMA compression, which brought down the size of the assets significantly. And I'm doing some clever stuff with the previews as well, which I'm not going to go into. But so getting that experience to fit in those 10 megabytes is a challenge. And the current editor code, it has a lot of dependencies because it does a lot of stuff. And maybe that's a sign that I haven't decoupled it enough. But mainly, the main reason really for me doing this is for fun, basically, for the challenge. because I really want to put some Swift UI code in production. So I think that's a good excuse.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think both app clips and widgets and adopting other kinds of features that are exclusive to either iOS 13 or 14 is a good chance to play around with Swift UI and combine and these other features without having to increase your minimum deployment target, right? Because you haven't decided exactly what your plans are around iOS 13 and 14, right? But this is a way for you to start doing some of that work without making that decision up front.
Yeah, I will say I am leaning towards increasing the deployment target to iOS 13.1.
Oh, right.
Because iOS 13 didn't even launch, basically, the 13.0. It didn't,
right.
Like, it lasted for, like, 3 days or something. So I don't think why support 13.0? If you're still running 13.0, I mean, you're nuts. But, yeah, so that's pretty much where I am right now, but it's not, like, sealed. Yeah, it's not a done deal. But yeah, I really want to put some Swift UI in production and see what happens. And of course, it's not going to be like, I'm not talking about 100% Swift UI, that isn't even a thing yet. But like the things such as the UI itself are probably going to be Swift UI. But I don't think I'm going to be like rewriting the actual canvas in Swift UI. I think that would be a huge undertaking. So that's probably going to be just the regular UI kit one.
Yeah, that sounds like a good approach. And again, like that's how Swift UI was designed to enable you to do things like that. Like you can build a shell using Swift UI with all the controls and the UI and then have the canvas be completely in UI kit. And that shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, I am tempted, though, to try and make the canvas in Swift UI just for fun. Again,
you know what's going to happen. You are going to write the whole thing. You're going to rewrite the whole thing. And then, yeah, we're going to see what's going to happen.
I have some questions with regards to how it would perform. But yeah, I have to try it out to see for myself.
Yeah, that'll be a great experiment, a good follow-up to my game. Just don't use the iCloud icon like I did. That's the biggest learning from that experiment.
No, I won't. So, John, I woke up today and I fired up Twitter and there was this tweet by a guy named John Sandel. And there was a link to a Q&A section with, I think, the far more frequently asked questions about Swift that people ask me. And I was so happy because now I have like a canonical answer that I can send to everyone. So tell me about this new project of yours.
Sure. Well, I'm glad to hear that it's going to be useful for you in that sense too. Not only, you know, as answers to the actual questions, but that you have an answer to link to. And yeah, so I launched a new Q&A feature on my website today. And this has been something I've been thinking about doing for quite a while. And there has been already a way for me to answer questions from the audience or from the community, and that's through the podcast, like the Swift by Sandel podcast that I do. And of course, we also have Ask Stacktrace on this show, but those questions tend to be slightly different in nature, not specifically about Swift all the time. But the thing with the podcast that I've been thinking about is that although it's been nice to answer people's questions on the show, there's a lot of disadvantages to answering questions in audio form. And number one is that you first have to like ask people for those questions, and people have to come up for new questions each episode. And usually there's kind of a narrow window where I will announce the new guest, and then like the next day we're recording. So a lot of people's questions we don't get on time. And of course I could announce the guest even earlier, but then I would have to plan that. So it becomes like a big machinery. Mm-hmm. And then the second most major biggest advantage of doing it on the podcast is that these questions are not super easy to find the answers to, right? Yeah. Like later. So it's not easy to search and find that kind of answer. And like you mentioned also, you don't have that canonical link that you can just give to people if someone asks you a question that you've already answered. Saying like, hey, just go listen to this podcast and this timestamp is, it's not a great link. I mean, I love podcasts and I will keep doing the podcast, and I think that a lot of people enjoy it. But just that particular part, like the utility of Q&A in that context, I feel like can be improved. So that's what I did on the website now instead. So I'm going to not do Q&A actually anymore as a main thing on the podcast. The episode that's coming out later this week as we record is actually not going to have Q&A in it. So it's a little bit of an experiment. We're going to see how that's what's going to happen. But I feel like by answering people's questions on the website instead, I will both be able to go into a lot more context. I will be able to provide code samples. I will have these answers there and people can search for them. They can find them later. And it's funny because when I started thinking about this feature, this is very typical of me, by the way, where I started thinking of doing it in a way simpler way, like that it would just be, you know, a question and then maybe one paragraph worth of answer. Like, here's the answer. But I can't do things that way. Like, I don't like to take shortcuts, and I don't like to just say like, here's a minimum answer and then, you know, quickly get it out the door and then, you know, take a shortcut and then let's move on. I like to do things thoroughly, and I like to make things the best they can be. I mean, of course, they're not going to be perfect, but I want to be proud of the things I make. Yep. And the same thing goes for this feature, is that I actually ended up writing like articles for each of these questions. So there's just going to be a new section on my website. You can go to swiftbysandel.com/questions, and you can see it already. I have answered, like you mentioned, 4 common questions, and I'm hoping to like pick up new questions every week and answer there as mini articles. So that's going to be in addition to all of the other things that I'm doing. So I'm really excited about this. I think it's going to be fun, and I hope it's going to be a good, valuable resource for the community to have these kind of my canonical answers for common questions.
Nice. Yeah, the thing you mentioned there about how you want to really take your time and do something you're proud of is very important. And some people actually get the wrong impression from some of the things I say. So I want to clarify here with a podcast that's not linkable and not searchable, so people will never find the answer. So when I say, like in my many view controllers talk, that you should be focused on shipping, it doesn't mean like the move fast and break things kind of shipping.
Right.
I mean, like, don't focus on the minor details in your code. You should use that attention to detail in the user experience instead. And the code behind it of course, affects the user experience to some extent, but your users are not going to care about if you use MVC or Viper or MVVM or whatever. They're going to care about different things. And if you spend all of your time just focusing on finding the right architecture and rewriting your app 100 times, your users are going to suffer for it. So that's what I mean. So focus your attention on detail to things that really matter.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think it's a balancing act, right? Like you want to make sure that the underlying implementation also is maintainable and has good enough quality as to not cause a lot of bugs either right now or in the future. But the main focus I always have is what's the end product, right? Like in this case, I spent way more time actually writing the content, coming up with code samples, picking the questions, you know, organizing them in a neat way, experimenting with how the UI would look, where I would place the buttons for navigating to this feature, how to make it visible. You know, all of these different things, I spent way more time on that than actually building the infrastructure for having questions on the site. And of course, part of that is also that I am writing in Swift, which is a language that I am super familiar with at this point, using a framework that I built myself, which is Publish. So of course, like I have quite good speed just because of those things. But then again, like I used all of my existing infrastructure for, you know, articles to build this. I did not like create a brand new advanced systems for, you know, I had all these ideas, like, should I enable people to like upvote questions or something like that? But I just chose to launch with a MVP, right? A minimum viable product that is something I'm proud of. And then let's see how it evolves. Like maybe I'll add upvoting later. Maybe I'll add other kinds of features specific to questions later. All depends on like how the feature will evolve and how I will feel about it in the future. It's better, I think, to start with something simple but polished rather than trying to go for breadth in the beginning. So Rambo, speaking of moving fast and breaking things, that's something that a certain company who I don't believe they still have that as their catchphrase, but they used to at least. They used to have that as like an engineering motto, move fast and break things. And we're of course talking about Facebook. And they're in the news again. Their SDK again started crashing, and numerous popular apps around the App Store started crashing because something that Facebook was doing automatically, you know, without any specific method call from the users, something that was done in the background, crashing the SDK and crashing apps. And so now we're moving into our In the News segment. And actually, because of this, Rambo, you were in the news. You were actually quoted by the BBC, your previous article around the Facebook SDK. So could you perhaps just talk a little bit about what happened here? Like, why was the Facebook SDK crashing yet again?
Well, this time it wasn't as bad as last time. Apparently, this time it will only crash if you had a certain toggle enabled on Facebook's like developer app configuration thing. And I don't remember the exact toggle, but it was something like to automatically do something that you can enable or disable. I don't know if it's enabled by default or not. Like the Jobby Job app was not crashing, and it was last time, but at the same time, like TikTok and I think Spotify as well, many other very popular high profile apps were crashing because of this.
All the food ordering apps were crashing. that's the thing I heard from a lot of people. And also the app I usually use here in Poland was crashing as well.
Yeah, this is what happened last time. Like my food ordering app was crashing and I almost went without dinner that night.
Exactly. That's why people are so outraged about this, Rambo, that they don't get their music and they don't get their food. That's like the two main things that people want.
Yeah, it was traumatizing. So the problem again was that something that the Facebook backend was sending to their SDK code was causing the SDK code to crash. And this is like, I mean, this is something that should not happen. Like your backend sending bad data should not cause your app or your SDK or whatever to crash. And it's easier said than done, of course, especially when you're working in Objective-C. I'm not saying that Objective-C is bad. I love Objective-C. I've said it a million times, but Swift's type safety does help here, unless you're using fatal error and bang everywhere. But if you are doing it right, it helps you here. Because when you are deserializing JSON, so when you're reading this data that comes in a certain format and you expect a text in something, and instead of a text, something else comes in there, like a number or something. If you don't handle it correctly in Objective-C, it will crash your app. And what's funny, well, not so funny, is that the crash can happen somewhere else completely unrelated to your actual parsing code, like the code that's reading the JSON. And I remember facing some of those in my Opt-C days. And you're going to see like underscore underscore NSCF tagged pointer string doesn't respond to selector int value or something.
Right.
And you're like, what the hell's going on? Like, where is this coming from? And it turns out like you expected an NS number and you read an NS string instead because that's what was in the JSON. That's like super common. But yeah, it says something, I guess, about their quality control situation, because one would expect this type of stuff to be tested like in a staging environment before being pushed to production, and that one of the components being tested would be their SDK, but apparently something has gone wrong in that process.
Yeah, and I don't want to get into the whole game of like blaming, you know, the engineers who wrote this code or something like that, because everyone can make a mistake, right? It doesn't matter if you work for Facebook or if you work for your small little startup that you just created in your bedroom, right? Like that doesn't matter. Anyone can make a mistake and that's fine. It happens, and it can happen twice, just like here. The thing that worries me about this, and the reason I'm even going to go out and say that I would recommend that if there is a way in your app to remove the Facebook SDK, I know it's not always possible, but if there is a way to remove it, if there is something you can do there, I would probably do that now, because it's not so much that the SDK can have a bug, because that can always happen, right? Like, again, anyone can make a mistake and that's fine. But the fact that they seem to be so aggressively running code automatically, like abusing the load method in Objective-C, right?
Yeah.
When the SDK is loaded into memory, they start running code, they do network calls, they do JSON serialization. That is really worrying to me. And I wouldn't want to be in a business where I have some SDK in my code, in my app, that is doing all of these things without me even invoking it. Like that's the thing people discovered last time, and you also wrote about it in your article, that people discovered that even if they commented out the call to the Facebook SDK, their app would still crash.
Yeah.
And sure, there were ways here to get around it, like you could disable auto initialization or something like that. But this, for me, is a big, big warning sign that this practice is used in this SDK, and I am sure it is in others too, but here we have a very concrete example of an SDK that apparently is doing a lot of operations that can fail, that are fragile, that are maybe not as tested as they should be, automatically on launch without any specific calls into the SDK. And that for me is really worrying.
Yeah, almost every one of these SDKs, and I'm looking at you, Facebook, Firebase, these SDKs are pretty much, I know it's not like that, but like pretty much every iOS app out there has, they do some really crappy stuff, like swizzling app delegate methods. I've had an SDK swizzle UI application send event, which is like a really hot code path that should never be touched by anything. And this SDK was just happily swizzling send event and inserting whatever its code was doing in between every single event happening in your application. So these are huge red flags that should never be allowed to be included in an SDK. Like this is something that it really drives me nuts that these SDKs are doing this type of stuff. It's something I wouldn't do in my code. Like, I wouldn't
right.
write code in my app to swizzle NS application send event. Like method swizzling, it can be useful. It can be used to work around bugs. And I'm fine with using it for those types of situations. But I would never like do something like swizzling NS application send event or swizzling my app delegate methods. I think the people who are developing these SDKs, and again, I'm not blaming the individual engineers, I'm blaming mostly management. I think they should think about the implications of them doing something like this. And again, most SDKs, they do have options for you to disable that stuff. But how do you know that it is in fact being disabled? And most people don't know we can be disabled. And I know they do it so that they're easier to integrate, so that you can just like link the SDK and it does its thing. But we can do better.
Yeah, I think if something like this is going to be included, like auto initialization and using load methods and swizzling and things like that, I would want that to be opt-in, right? Yeah. Like even something where when you download the SDK, like let me check some checkbox and you would give me a different version of the framework if I want it to be auto initialized every time. Like by default, I don't think that this should be the behavior. And I think that that goes into like general coding practices, right? Like if you're writing a tool that is going to be used by other developers, I think it's very important always to keep in mind that you don't know what exact environment you're going to be executing in. And if you just start abusing that environment and you start like, you know, you're going into someone's house and treating it like your own, basically, like that is not good in terms of practice, I don't think. So I think if, you know, whoever's working on SDK out there, and you know, I work on a lot of developers tools too, I always try and I always encourage other people to try the best they can to be like good citizens, right? Like not only on the platform, but also like try to be transparent with the users of your tools and to not like overstep your boundaries. And I think the least you can do is that not kick off any functionality before the consumer of your SDK is actually calling you and asking you to do work.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, it happened again. And I am happy that I'm being used as a source for all these stories about yeah. the thing, because you see many times like the media will write about this stuff without knowing exactly what's going on. And I'm just happy that they're using someone, like it doesn't have to be me, but that they're using a technical source who knows what's going on to inform the readers. I'm very happy about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we also have another in the news topic here for this week's episode. And that one comes from our good friend, John Gruber. So Rambo, what do we have here?
So this is a moment of clarity regarding the raison d'être for the App Store. And excuse my French there.
Nice pronunciation.
So the gist of this piece is talking about how there's been all of this situation with the Hey App and things like that, and how Apple controls the App Store to a certain extent, and maybe too much of an extent for some people. And that most of their focus seems to be with regards to you're not giving us money, and it should actually be about the quality of what's being put in the App Store. So he mentions in this case the Google Gmail app, which was recently updated to support split screen multitasking on iPad after like 5 years of the feature existing in the platform, and yeah. that maybe Apple should be enforcing these types of requirements instead of enforcing the other rules that, in his opinion, are mainly to increase their services revenue and not necessarily the user experience.
Yeah, and maybe this is the type of thing where you're always kind of glorifying the past or modifying the past in your memory, but it feels like that used to be more of the case in the early days of the App Store, and now we're talking like before in-app purchases even existed, right? And before subscriptions and all of these different things. It felt like there was a lot more control on the kind of quality and user interface and things like that and functionality of apps in the beginning. Maybe also this is a thing that was hard to scale. Maybe it's a thing where, you know, the Apple's priorities shifted and things like that. But it does feel like that part of the App Store has definitely changed over time. And, you know, there's just a huge amount of apps these days that are being submitted and, you know, millions of apps on the store and all these things. So I also understand that it's hard for Apple to kind of, you know, quality assure each app that goes in there and to make sure that each app supports all of these different features. But I also think that there's an interesting question here where does being on the App Store come with certain requirements, or does it come with certain obligations as a developer in terms of keeping your app up to date?
Yeah, it's really tricky. And what they've been doing currently already causes a lot of frustration to developers. I remember, I think it was very recent, or maybe it's happening right now, but some developers who, or people who aren't even developers, but they're designers, and made iMessage sticker apps in like the first version of the iMessage App Store back in iOS 10. And to clarify, like iMessage sticker packs, they are just a bundle with assets and I guess a stub executable. Like they don't have code in them. That's why many designers actually made sticker packs. And Apple advertised it as so. Like you don't even need to be a developer. You can just put the assets here and submit it. But now they're like requiring these sticker pack messages apps to be rebuilt using the latest SDK or something like that. And like, come on, that's kind of ridiculous. Like it doesn't even have code inside of it. So I think if they increased this even more, I think it would just cause more frustration and it would cause more problems for them in the antitrust situation. And to be clear here, I would love if this was the case. Like, I would love to be able to use picture-in-picture on YouTube, on my iPad, and things like that. But I think I'm being realistic here. I think in reality, it will be very hard for them to actually do this. For instance, like, let's say there's a rule that's like, every video player app needs to support picture-in-picture. Pretty simple rule, right?
Yeah.
But what is a video playing app?
What is a computer?
Exactly. Like, and then you start having these problems because the rule is too broad and too abstract. Because let's say like the Jobby app, like in an offer that you're looking at, the description of the offer can have an embedded video. And it doesn't support picture-in-picture because those are embedded YouTube videos. Well, I guess if you put them in full screen, you technically can. But for the sake of argument, let's say that it doesn't support. And then we submit like a bug fix update to the App Store and our e-commerce app is rejected because we don't support picture-in-picture. Like,
right.
And you would get lots of situations like that. Like, so the person who's reviewing the app will like see a video and maybe it's like a background video just for effect and they're going to be like, no, reject it, doesn't support picture in picture. And I think, and that's just one rule. Imagine all of the others like multi-window support, split screen. Well, split screen they are actually enforcing, so that's not the case here. But yeah, I think it would just make things even more complicated. It will frustrate developers even more. And yeah, I don't think it would work in reality, even though I would love for it to be the case.
Yeah, I do agree with you. I'm very conflicted about this, where I also agree that I would love to see it. I would love for all of the at least major apps, let's say like the top 1,000 apps on the App Store, to be modern, to support all the modern features, to support both iPhone and iPad features, to have like Apple Watch integration and support handoff and all of these different things that would just make the whole ecosystem so nice if you could always assume that a given app supports all of these platform features. But at the same time, we already have, I feel like, with modern software, especially on iOS, a kind of huge problem with backwards compatibility and the software just being left, you know, to not run anymore. We saw that with 64-bit, you know, moving from 32-bit to 64-bit, a lot of, especially games that are not apps that are being maintained and updated every week, like bug fixes and improvements every 2 weeks. Like these apps, they just stop working. And I know why, and I'm sure that, you know, that was a good decision in the long run. But I feel like if we keep moving too far in that direction where we just leave, let's say, old software behind, it's going to be kind of sad where you can only use all of the apps that are continuously updated all the time on your latest device. And in order to play that game you really loved from a couple of years ago, or to use this app that is maybe no longer updated because the company went out of business or whatever, they stopped working on it, you cannot use that anymore. Like, all of those situations would be kind of sad. So I'm also kind of on that side of things. So I'm really conflicted here. I would love to see apps being maintained and updated and kept up to date and support all the latest features. But I also, you know, I'm very cautious about not leaving too much software and software history really behind.
Yeah. And also, this assumes that every new feature and the API that is involved with it is good.
Right.
But what if the API sucks? Like,
yeah, what if it becomes a flop, right? Like, not everything that Apple launches becomes an immediate hit.
Yeah.
And, you know, take widgets, for example, that they're launching now. I think widgets will probably be quite popular. It seems like there's a lot of excitement around that from developers and also from users. So that's probably, you know, going to be at least a thing. But it could also flop, right? It could also just go nowhere. And then, you know, are developers going to be forced to maintain their widget even though nobody's using it? Like, that doesn't seem fair. So yeah, it's a very tricky situation. And like you say also, it's so hard to write rules. It's almost like you're writing laws, right? Like in a law book, in a legal book, where you have to consider all of these thousand edge cases. And all of a sudden, this rule to include picture-in-picture or split screen or whatever becomes this huge paragraph with all these different edge cases. And nobody wants that either. Like, you don't want to have to be like an App Store review guidelines lawyer in order to understand how to build an app.
Yeah, and imagine the amount of training that the people who are reviewing the apps would have to get for this to be viable. They would have to like almost become QA engineers in a sense. And I don't think that's something that's scalable. And there's also like the aspect of, I'm a developer, I know what I'm doing. Like, I don't want to support multi-window in Chibi Studio, for instance. First, because I hate that API. I'm sorry to the people at Apple, but I'm not going to use an S-user activity for one more thing. And it's really clunky, and you have to put this stuff in your info.py list. I don't like it. If I had an app, like a text editor app that you could have multiple documents open, then I would definitely like go through the hassle of implementing it. But Chibi Studio, like, most people who use it don't even know the iPad can open multiple windows. And I don't think it makes sense for you to have, like, five chibis on screen at the same time and edit them all at the same time. So I'm not going to support it. And I think I know what I'm doing. It's my app. I know my users. I know what's important. But if Apple, like, suddenly mandated that all apps must support multi-window on iPad, I will have to spend like weeks making my app work with that for pretty much no one to use it. And that would be sad. And another thing I don't necessarily agree about Gruber's piece is with the sense that people who use Gmail only use it because they are like forced into using it. Like they don't know any better and they use it because they are required to use it. I don't agree. Like, I think you can use Gmail on your browser. Like, I don't have the Gmail app. I do have a Gmail account, and my corporate email is also Gmail. And I just use the browser, and it works. Like, it's not something that I'm even thinking about. Like, oh, I have to use the browser to use Gmail. I just use it. Like, it's fine. And I think if there are some apps out there that are of lower quality, and there is a segment of users who are willing to use it and they're fine with it, then fine, let them have it.
Yeah, I think the concern here, or like the frustration with maybe Google apps in particular, is that there almost seems to be this battle between Google and Apple, and that Google is like holding back features for negotiation purposes, right? Like, we talked about it in the context of like YouTube and 4K, right, on the Apple TV and things like that. And I don't know anything about what's going on behind the scenes, so I don't want to make any assumptions. But there is a frustration there from end users of like, why can't I just use this feature? Like, it seems, why don't you just support it, right? Like, it seems so easy. Why don't you just do it? And I think that this is the case here as well, where it's like, come on, adding split screen support to an email app, come on, just do it, right? Like, there's that feeling among people. And I get that, but I also agree with you. Like, I think it should be ultimately the developer's choice regarding what platform features to support. But it also comes down to Apple, I think, where, like you mentioned, multiple windows, for example, it's quite undiscoverable. And I use the iPad all the time. I don't think I've almost never used multiple window support on iPad, and I've only triggered it like accidentally.
Yep, same.
And that's, I think, also a problem where if the OS does not surface these features enough, if they don't make them intuitive enough, then there's not that much motivation for developers to implement. And like you just mentioned, and I feel like that also needs to be a driving force here, not Apple saying, well, you need to support this or else you're out of the store. They should make the feature so good and so compelling and that users love it, like they say in the keynotes, so that you want to implement it, right? Like, yeah. Imagine if you were getting lots of emails from people like, hey, we love your app, Rambo, but we use it on the iPad, but we can't use multiple windows. Come on, just add it. Yeah. Then you would probably do that work, right? Like, yeah. I feel like that's the force that should motivate developers to do the work, not some policy from Apple. So I think now I'm more on the developers should decide camp now after this little discussion.
There is another aspect, though, that I think has been overlooked by most people discussing this matter, and that's the marketing aspect and the control that Apple has over marketing things in the App Store. And I think that's where they could actually do something about it. And in fact, I know that they are doing something in that direction. Because I know of multiple situations, especially with like bigger companies, where someone from Apple App Store marketing or dev relations, I don't know the exact person who does it, comes up to a company or a developer and they say, we would really like to feature your app. If only it would support this one feature, like, I don't know, picture-in-picture or widgets or whatever. It has happened before with people I know, and I think maybe they should use it more. Like, maybe if your app doesn't support the features, you can put it in the App Store. That's fine. People can download it, but like, you're not going to show up in charts or you're not going to be featured or something like that. I think I would be totally fine with them doing that, because then it's like, okay, you can have your app in the App Store, but we're not going to promote it because we don't feel like it's a good platform citizen.
Yeah, I feel like that's also could be a great solution. And that's a distinction a lot of people have been making lately around the, you know, 30% debate, right? Like that the fact that developers have to give Apple 30% of their revenue coming from the App Store, that there's a difference between providing the app on the store and hosting the app on the store versus promoting it, right? And I feel like that's an important distinction to make as well, where Apple being like in the monopoly situation where that's the only way to get apps on a phone apart from test flight and building it yourself and things like that, that kind of also requires them to do provide like a fair market and a place where people can put their apps. But I don't think anyone is saying that that also forces them to promote them, right? And that's a tool they could use to motivate developers as well. They could use many different tools, both carrots and sticks, to motivate developers to implement certain features.
Yeah, I think the carrots would work better in this case. And I'm not talking about Kara Weather because, yeah, she's not very nice. But yeah, I think that would be a sweet solution, I may say so myself. But they could even like put like unlisted apps. Like you can have your app in the App Store. It's going to be unlisted. It's not going to even show up in search. But if people open up a link, then it shows up. I don't know. I think they could even go to that direction. And that would definitely be a solution for things such as the Hey app, because their users are not going to come from the App Store. It's the opposite. They're going to be their customers and then they're going to download the app. So if you are collecting your users, you're not relying on App Store discoverability, which, by the way, you should not, then I don't know. You don't even need your app to show up in the App Store at all. Like if you can send your users a link and they can open it and download the app, that's fine.
Yeah, it's kind of the difference between using the store as a discoverability tool versus just using it as a server, right? Just as a CDN, basically, for your binary. So yeah, I think there are a bunch of different ways that Apple could go here. And I hope that they go in a way where they can motivate developers to keep their apps up to date, but also keep apps on the store that maybe are not maintained anymore, because I would still love to play, especially my old games. I don't want games to disappear anymore, Rambo.
Your precious games.
I was just looking at my Steam library the other day, and because of the Mac now also moving to 64-bit only, I couldn't play like, you know, 90% of the games in there because they're never going to get updated. So yeah, I'm a little bit sad about that. But now let's move into an exciting topic. And we're going to do a slightly quicker deep dive on this episode because we're already almost an hour in, but we still want to do it. We want to go on a deep dive into backend-driven UI.
It's going to be a shallow dive.
Right, a shallow deep dive. Maybe like we dive deep, but then come up quick. Let's see if that's going to work out. So, Rambo, you wanted to talk about this topic in particular, which is kind of interesting because if people have been following me for a few years before I was writing articles and podcasting and things like that, I was working at Spotify and I was working on backend-driven UI quite a bit. So, but it was you who wanted to talk about this thing, which I find kind of interesting. So can you tell me a little bit about what's the context here?
Well, this is mostly a plot for me to get your help without paying your consultancy fee.
Clever.
Yeah, so we are starting at a job using the concept of BFF, not best friends forever. It means backend for frontend. And these are two different concepts, but one of the things we are going to do for certain aspects of the project is use this more backend-driven UI approach. So mainly I would want to know from you about your experience with it and what are some of the gotchas that people should look out for. But just to define it here for people who don't know what we're talking about. So instead of, say, your app going to your backend and asking for, I don't know, a list of products, and the backend is going to return like a list of products with an ID and a title and whatever. And then like in your app, you're going to parse that information and format it and create views. And you're going to lay those out in your app however the app wants to. Instead, the backend is actually going to give you something that's more akin to HTML in a sense. It's going to give you, it's not going to be HTML, it's going to be JSON or something else, but it's going to give you a more visual representation of what you should display. And then the app will almost act like the CSS and JavaScript in a way. I'm using these analogies, but I think they actually work quite well because you're going to get the data in a more structured way that's more similar to what's going to go on screen. And then your app is going to just basically lay out things and act on them. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, I think so. One way that I typically was describing it in the past is that instead of sending models from your backend, just the data, you're basically sending view models.
Perfect.
So you're sending fully serialized view models. And just to give a very concrete example, let's say that you're building an app for displaying articles. And your article model, it has like a title, it has a description, maybe it has an array of comments, maybe it has like a rating, an author, and so on and so forth. Like properties that are specific to an article model. And just like you described, Rambo, in the typical kind of setup that a lot of apps are using, you would call your backend, you would get maybe an array of articles, and then you would render them using rules that are defined on the client side. So the app knows how to decode an article instance. It knows to take the title and make that the main title of a table view cell, for example. It knows to take the description and make that the subtitle. It knows exactly how to render a comment and things like that. With backend-driven UIs, you're instead trying to generalize things a little bit more to say, instead of sending just an article, let me just send a component or a something. You can call it whatever you want, but a component, you're sending a more generic model that can describe more or less anything. So it just has things like title, subtitle, image. Instead of an array of comments, it can have an array of child views, right? So you're sending a hierarchy of view models from your backend, and then all that the client really knows how to do is to then take those view models and structure them and render them in a UI. So it knows, for example, what is a row or what is a card or what is a list, but it doesn't really know what's an article list in specific terms, right? So the goal of all of this, it might sound like, you know, why would you do this? The goal of it is to give you much more flexibility around what kind of combinations of data that you're sending from your backend, and to be able to iterate on things like layout, to be able to compose things in different ways, of course, not to reinvent HTML like you were joking about before. You don't want to give yourself too much flexibility, but to give yourself enough flexibility so that if you have, for example, if we take the Spotify app, for example, that I was working on, if you have like the browse view in the Spotify app where you can see like recommended playlists and recommended songs and things like that, that you can iterate on that UI and send different like ways of displaying that data. You can send grids and carousels and lists and featured items and whatever you want completely dynamically without having to update the client every single time. That gives you a lot of flexibility.
Yeah, the reason we decided to go with this route was, first of all, because we were already starting with the BFF project for another reason. And then with this new project, when we got the material from HI and the product team, we looked at each other and we were like, yeah, this is kind of tricky. Like, it's going to be a lot of business logic. So the main goal here is to abstract all of that business logic to the BFF and the backend and leave the apps to do what they do the best, which is laying out things, doing animations and acting on things and things like that. Mainly because it's a very flexible UI and it depends on lots and lots of variables that the backend knows better than the client. So right. That was our main like decision-making point there. And also because we're not going to be duplicating all of this logic, like this business logic of which module should I show here or there or what should I hide. We're abstracting that, and so we're not duplicating it between our iOS and Android clients, because we don't use like React Native or Flutter or something where we have a single code base. They are separate native code bases for each platform. So this way we get the benefits of unifying this business logic while at the same time maintaining the separated code base with all of the advantages that you get from native applications.
Yeah, that sounds really, really good. You asked me for gotchas there in the beginning, so yep. I want to kind of segue into that, where it sounds now maybe that this is like a perfect architecture and wow, you can write things once on the backend side and then Android and iOS will just update. But of course, you also have to build out the system, right? You have to build out the components, you have to build out this rendering system, you have to decide what kind of combinations should we support, because again, you don't want to reinvent HTML, so you do have to put some constraints in there. Maybe you just define that you want to have lists and grids and maybe like a, you know, horizontally scrolling carousel and things like that. And then you can play around with those components.
So we are limiting a lot what we're doing with this. And this was one of the decisions we had at the beginning, like, let's do the minimum necessary to get this project going. Let's not be too flexible, because that can be a huge time sink. Like, being extremely flexible, like anything can come from the backend and we're going to render it. No, that won't work. So we are being quite strict in the beginning.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very, very good idea, because this approach, like every approach, has pros and cons, right? Yeah. And the cons here is that you end up building something that is extremely flexible, which is great in terms of what you can do with it, but it's also going to be complex in terms of the implementation. You're going to have a very complex UI implementation in order to support all these permutations. And once you have that in place, that's great. It gives you this flexibility to iterate, to present content in different ways, like we just talked about. But you're also then going to have to maintain that, update that as the platform changes. So it does come with a technical cost. And it's just a cost-benefit analysis, really, where you have to say, okay, is it worth it to build this flexibility in this particular view? And that's something that we went through a lot, for example, at Spotify. And I know that they've continued to iterate that. You know, I haven't worked there for almost 4 years now, so they've iterated a lot on these different things. The framework we built at Spotify, me and the team that I was working with, we actually open sourced that and it's on GitHub, but they then ended up deprecating it because they moved on with a different tool doing the same thing. You know, classic big company, like if they're not moving fast and breaking things, they are rewriting all the things all the time. That's another big company thing. But they're still using the same architecture for certain views. And I think that is key, where this is not something that you want to build your entire app using. You don't want to build like your most sophisticated screens that have lots of animations and controls and things like that using something like this, because it would be really difficult to describe that kind of user interface from the back end. Like, essentially, you want to be able to build only the UIs where you can easily describe them as a JSON file, as a serialized format. And usually that will be like your list screens and your content screens and things like that. This is where this approach can really shine. And you don't have to go the entire way of saying, let me build it entirely backend driven. But if you can just have like a couple of different components that you can switch between, and then in your collection view, you just use different collection view cells depending on some identifier in your JSON, you've already unlocked a lot of flexibility just by doing that. You don't have to go and build an entire like backend driven UI renderer just to make that happen. So that would be the biggest learning, I would say, that I want to share with you and our audience here, is that you don't want to use this for everything. And that was never honestly my kind of intention with pursuing this in the beginning either. I always thought that it was the best used for kind of content driven views. And that's the opinion I have today as well.
Yeah, definitely. Something like we decided from the get-go was like, let's not have our backend send callers to the client. Like, that was right. One of the things. Yeah. Like, let's not go to that extent of customizability. Basically what we are going to use it for is content. Like, it's stuff it's basically content, and you tap the content and it opens a deep link into another part of the app. That's it. Like, it's not going to be like interactive stuff or super mutable stuff. Like, let's say you have like a product that comes from this particular backend driven UI. There's a link associated with the product. You tap the link and you go like to your shopping cart. That shopping cart, it's not going to be backend driven UI. It's going to be just the regular stuff. So yeah, it's basically for content.
Yeah, exactly. And like I mentioned, you can do this in so many different ways, like, and different degrees of backend driven UI. But I do think that the core idea for kind of content driven lists is really powerful and something I'm still using in certain apps to this day. You know, I was just recently working on an app where we used this approach to render like a timeline where you could have like an image and you could have comment fields and you could have videos and things like that. All these content types were predefined, but the backend was deciding when to show what. So the client just took that data and rendered the different components for it. And that wasn't nearly as kind of powerful or flexible as something that I did when I was working in Spotify, but it still solved the same kind of problem, right? So I think you can definitely choose what degree of flexibility that you need. And again, I would really, like we've talked about now a few times, but I would really emphasize that one more time, to not generalize things more than you have to, right? Because it's super beautiful to have a generic system where it can render anything, right? That's so cool from a kind of engineering point of view, but that's going to be harder to maintain. So it's always nice to have constraints. Constraints is always my big friend.
Yeah. Then you're writing a browser engine.
Exactly, which can be fun as well, but that's perhaps not what you want to do. So it sounds like you're on the right track, and especially combined with backend for frontend that you mentioned there, which is, you know, when client developers can also contribute to the backend code, that there's some kind of framework in place to enable client-side developers to easily like self-service on the JSON they get back and modify it and write backend code. That is also super powerful from a teamwork perspective, I think, where you get more teamwork between the backend developers and the client-side developers.
All right. Thank you very much. You can invoice me later.
Will do. But I think that is a good place to end this episode. So feel free to send us your Ask Stacktrace questions, because we do want to answer more questions on upcoming episodes. You can tweet with the hashtag Ask Stacktrace any question that you would like us to answer. And you can now also tweet with Ask Sundell if you want to include that question on Swift by Sundell as well. So there's many options here for asking, but of course, we always want to hear questions here for the show as well. But that's it for this episode. So all that remains is for us to thank you so much for listening, and for Mr. Rambo to say goodbye.
Goodbye.